Welcome to episode 11 of Practical Defense, Home Security, Part 1. Welcome back to another episode of Practical Defense. I'm your host, Alex Addicks. In this episode, we're going to cover a topic applicable to everyone and anyone: home security measures. And there's lots of material here. So there are going to be at least 2 episodes, and perhaps even 3 episodes on this topic. Now, security tips I'm going to discuss here are not guaranteed to prevent a break into your home. No one can guarantee that. But, like with everything I talk about, these are recommendations and suggestions that'll help keep you safer and more secure. But unfortunately, if someone really wants to hurt you or really wants your stuff, they're going to figure out a way to get it. Also, there are just circumstances when you've done everything perfectly. You've taken every precaution, and the stars are just aligned against you. You know, sometimes bad luck is just bad luck. And you'll notice that home security is actually very similar to personal security. You're not trying to set traps for a criminal. You're not trying to capture the criminal. And actually, on a quick side note, setting a trap in your home for invaders or trespassers is illegal in the United States. But what it is your goal here is to become a hard target, someone that is not worth the effort to attack or to steal from. You want to make them think that you're too much trouble to bother with, and they'll move on to an easier target. And that's one of the challenges of conflict and crime avoidance. The only evidence that you dodged a potentially dangerous situation is that you've never had a potentially dangerous situation. And the thing is, that sort of statistic is pretty much impossible to measure and quantify. But before we jump into the topic, I want to share an email I received this week from a listener. And this mail comes from Michael in Manassas, Virginia. I hope I didn't butcher the city name too badly, but it's from Virginia. And he writes, "I had meant to write to you and thank you, but also wanted to let you know how you have already helped me out. I traveled to see my grandparents today, but because of their small home, I had to stay in a hotel. I followed your instructions to a T. Situational awareness, making sure the desk clerk didn't say my room number, leaving the door open while I checked my room, etc. My hotel room is on the first floor, and the window faces the back of the hotel to a dimly lit parking lot. And guess what? The sliding window, which has no screen, was unlocked. Anybody could have easily opened the window and entered my room while I was asleep and robbed me, or worse. So thanks again. I've already recommended your podcast to all of my friends and asked my wife to listen to the entire series." Well, Michael, I'm really happy to hear that you caught that unlocked window. And whenever I come across an unlocked window in a hotel room, I really always wonder if it was deliberate. But the good news is, you'll never have to know. So thanks for writing in and sharing your personal experience with the rest of us. All right, so what is our first home security recommendation? It's lights. This is something that's easy, it's cheap, and it's highly effective. And what it comes down to is that criminals do not like to be seen when they're doing their thing. Lights make them visible and make them feel uncomfortable. And every home security recommendation list, every police officer, every security expert I've ever spoken with has always put lights at the top of their list. So light up your home with exterior lighting. You need to cover your home and the vulnerable areas around your property. These areas should, at a minimum, include windows and doors. And also, the sides of your home should be covered. And I'm talking about the front, the back, and the sides. All right, did I really say the back of the house? Absolutely. If you have the front of your house covered, and or even the sides, it's very easy for a burglar to creep down on your neighbor's property, who may not have taken the same precautions you have, and just pop over the wall into your darkened backyard, and then they can do what they want. So what we have to consider is, what is a wall or a fence to a criminal? And really, it's nothing. It's just a minor inconvenience, or even something that they use to hide behind. And that's the trap that we as honest citizens fall into. We see a wall as a barrier, you know, a line that says, "Do not cross." But a wall has no meaning to the criminal. The social norms that bind society together, you know, these unwritten rules of community that make life possible in our compacted urban environments, they don't apply to a criminal. They have no regard for them, and in many cases, they even use them to gain an advantage over us. All right, I digress here a bit, so let's go back to the lights. The short of it is that you need to treat the back of your house just like you'd treat the front. You know, you would lock your front door and you would light it up. You should also lock your back doors and light them up. So you need to think about the environment of your backyard at night. You know, it's walled on three sides. It has high bushes and shrubs to keep the neighbors' prying eyes away and to dampen any noise from the kids next door. And it's dark. So when you put that into those terms, doesn't it sound like a perfect environment for a criminal to work in? You bet it does. So you need to light that puppy up. There are several different types of lights and lighting possibilities, and the good news is that they're all effective. So there are lots of options depending upon your type of property and your budget. The first thing you need to understand is you don't need to light up every inch of your property with blinding high-intensity light. If some light is not going to deter the criminal, a whole lot of light is not going to do any better. So there's a happy balance that's really easy to achieve. To start, let's talk about placement. You want lighting out your front door, your side doors, your back doors, and any garage entrances. If you have other vulnerable areas on your property, you want to light those up as well. Just walk around your home after dark and look at it from the eyes of a criminal. Where are the places to hide? Where are the places to break in? Where would you want to sit for a while you do your work? How would you move around and stay hidden? Then all you have to do is put measures in place to help expose those areas and expose any movements. And if you have children, and men, hear me on this one, if you have teenage daughters, put a light outside their bedroom window. Now, there are many different types of lights and lighting systems. And the most common are, of course, the manual type that you turn on with a switch. And these are like your standard porch light. And every home has at least one of these at the front. But there are also spotlights and flood lamps that are really pretty bright and usually use halogen bulbs. And again, these can be turned on with a manual switch. What I really like are the motion-sensitive lights. Now, these stay off until something passes in front of a sensor that triggers a light, and then the light turns on and bathes the area in a nice bright light. What this does is it saves on your power bill while still providing some good security. It also acts as kind of like a gotcha for anyone passing in front of it. And it clearly states, hey, you've been caught creeping around when it pops on. And even when I have mine in my house and I'm walking around and not thinking about what I'm doing, all of a sudden the light pops on, it scares me. So you can only imagine a criminal who's trying to sneak through the property and all of a sudden, boom, he gets, big light flashed in his face. So motion-sensitive lights are also a good choice for placing around bedroom windows. So they're not always on, which is nice for people that might have trouble sleeping with a constant light outside their window. But also, when it triggers, it bathes the entire window frame, even, if you have blinds or, curtains or something like that up. The glow of the light still penetrates that, so it works as a very nice, quiet alert that something's happening outside. The downside to motion-sensitive lights is that they can trigger on all sorts of things. I've had mine trigger on neighborhood cats, skunks, raccoons, and even my hammock one time when I left it outside on a windy night. Now, the labels on these lights, they all promise they won't trigger on anything smaller than a dog, but they do. What they won't trigger on are like trees and things like that, or anything really small like mice, rats, squirrels, or small birds. But pretty much anything cat-sized or larger is going to trigger it. Also, my sister, who had some installed, had to relocate one of her motion-sensitive lights that she had installed on the side of her house. It kept triggering on some critters crawling along the top of the fence separating her yard from her neighbors. And when it turned on, it kept sending this blinding light right into the neighbor's bedroom window and waking them up. So, among other things, you also need to consider your neighbor's annoyance when you are choosing a location for your lights. There are also lights that turn on and off by themselves, and this is done either with a timer or a built-in light sensor. And this way, once they're set, you only have to worry about changing the burned-out bulbs rather than trying to remember if you turned them on before you crawled into bed. I really like the light-sensing lights. They're also called photoelectric or dusk-to-dawn lights. And what they do is they have a little light sensor in them, and when it gets dark enough, the lights automatically turn on. So when the sun goes down or it's on a cold, dark day, they turn on. And when the sun comes up in the morning, they turn off. So this is great for weather changes or even seasonal changes when it gets dark earlier or later, depending upon the time of year. rather than having to go out and reset your timer for daylight savings time or, you know, the summers that have longer days. It's all automatic. Don't have to worry about it. Now let's talk about bulbs and brightness. And as I mentioned earlier, you really don't need to go overboard on brightness. You know, a fair amount of light to see by is really all that's needed. And in most cases, you know, a 60-watt light bulb and a porch light is really all that's necessary. And of course, anything I might suggest needs to be taken into context. You always need to consider your personal layout of your home and any special circumstances that you might have. And if you want to go brighter, go brighter. It doesn't make any difference. Always do what you're comfortable with. Personally, I use the new energy-efficient compact fluorescent light bulbs in my porch lights. And they have a lot of advantages over the filament bulbs. Now, first, they provide a good amount of light while keeping your power bill under control. And second, they generate almost no heat. And heat will cause premature bulb blowout faster than anything I know short of hitting them. And because the compact fluorescent bulbs generate almost no heat, they're perfect for putting into those small waterproof outdoor fixtures. They also have a much longer life than a standard filament bulb. Now, the downside is that they are a little more expensive. But, you know, over the past year or two, I've seen the cost of these bulbs, the compact fluorescent bulbs, drop dramatically. Because as the technology is getting improved and they're becoming more and more popular because of the green movement, prices really should continue to fall. And in fact, in California, there is a movement that's starting to try and actually ban filament bulbs entirely and force everyone to the compact fluorescent bulbs. I don't know if that's actually a fixed thing or if it's still just a bill, but, you know, it's California. Now, for floodlights or spotlights, you have a couple of choices. And the first one's a fair amount of work, and it calls for mounting and hardwiring the lights to the side of your house. Usually, this requires an electrician because you have to tap into your home's power lines, cut holes into the walls and siding, go up on ladders and mount stuff. You know, if you're a super handyman with the experience in electrical work, you could probably do it yourself. In fact, I've helped a buddy of mine install some hardwired motion-sensitive lights on the side of his house, and it was not easy. It was a whole afternoon. And if you have any doubts, hire a professional. The other cool thing about the hardwired lights is that you can link them together so that when one light triggers, a whole series will go off and light up the entire yard. It's kind of a nifty idea. A second choice is to use solar-powered and motion-sensitive spotlights. So solar-powered, motion-sensitive spotlights. And they do have some advantages over the hardwired lights. First, they're really easy to install. And when I put mine up, it only took me about 15 minutes per light. And second, they work independently of the home's power. And this can come in handy if there's a power outage in your neighborhood, or if the burglar cuts the power to your home to try and circumvent an alarm system. The solar-powered lights, since they're not tied to the house's power, will still be operational and still work. But of course, there are also some downsides. First, the solar-powered ones, because they work off batteries, aren't as bright as the hardwired lights, but they still provide a really good amount of light. The second is that you need to place the solar collector panel, and these panels aren't very big. I mean, they're only like 4 inches across, 4x4. But they need to be put into direct sunlight for a good portion of the day. And for me in California, it's really not a problem. But if you live in a northern climate where you get snow or leaves, not as much bright, you know, sunlight like we have here in the desert, it could have a little bit of trouble with charging the batteries. The other thing is that depending upon which model you buy, you're going to have trouble with the amount of charges in the battery. Sometimes they, depending upon the brightness of the light, they can have as few as 20 triggers in a night, or 50 or 100. So it's not going to be unlimited, but I mean, how often is it really going to trigger over the course of the night? Hopefully not more than a couple of times, and hopefully not more than a couple of times a week. Now, at my home, I actually use a combination of the dusk to dawn porch lights all around the doors, and then I also have a bunch of strategically placed solar-powered motion-sensitive lights. And it's a pretty good combo, I think. Well, that's all the time I have for this episode, but there's a lot more to discuss on this topic, which I'll be covering in next couple of episodes. But before I cut out entirely, I wanted to, of course, talk about the classes. Now, I've actually added a new class for the end of February. This is a knife survival course, and this is a Jim Wagner knife survival course. I'm running it on the last Sunday in February, which is Sunday, February 24th, and this is a full 8-hour course. Now, over the course of the course, we cover a good range of topics. We do directional attacks. We talk about the 21 feet, 7 meter rule, also called like the Tooler drill. We do legal issues. We do use of force ladder and a whole bunch of other stuff. And this course is not in traditional martial arts, you know, come at me like this type course. But it teaches you how to survive a realistic full speed attack from a brutal attacker. And to understand how to defend against a knife, you need to know how to effectively use one yourself in a conflict situation. So what we do is we spend the morning learning how to use knives in a conflict, and then the afternoon we spend exclusively working on the defensive measures against the knife attacks. And next to the Women's Survival course, this is my most popular class. The sign-up form should be on live on my site by the end of the week, and I'm expecting the class to fill up pretty quickly, so if you're interested, be certain to save your spot. And of course, we're still planning on doing the Women's Survival course at the end of January. And it's only 20 days away. It's getting really close here. And I still have a couple of openings available if you want to sign up for it. And this is a women's only survival course designed by Sergeant Jim Wagner. It's 2 days. It's the last two Sundays in January. It's a full 16 hours. It's not like I'm running one day and then the same thing the next weekend. It's a full 2-day course, full 16 hours. And we cover, you know, threat zones, conflict defense strategies, stalking detection, harassment, vehicles, man-to-hand defense, weapon defense, use of force ladder, home security, and all sorts of other stuff. So it's a really, really good course, and all the women in my family have been through it. It's good stuff, and I really highly recommend it. We cover a lot of very important details and topics specific to women. And again, women only, and there aren't going to be any men even allowed to watch. So it's going to be me, my assistant, and the rest of the class is just going to be women. And the whole point of that is to make the women feel comfortable, because a lot of the women, they avoid these types of classes or even martial arts because they're afraid of being watched and scrutinized and evaluated and criticized. So we're not going to do any of that in this course. That's not going to be what we're doing. So that's why it's women only, with no men there except me and my assistant. Well, that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions and commentary, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com. Until next time, stay aware and stay safe.